have known it was too good to be true right from the start. When did anything we acquired in the Pegasus Galaxy ever come easily? My life was a testament to that.
You should have known, Dr. Weir. That was your job. That was the whole point of you.
Stop it! Stop! Why do you need to do this? You have me! You don't need to make me relive this, all these voices in my head. These memories of my life when I was... When I was...
Human.
When I was whole. Before this... It wasn't always difficult. I always hoped that there was a better moment coming around the corner. How was I to know what would happen? That day was a hopeful one. I watched as Shepard's team disembarked from the puddle jumper. They seemed in high spirits, all except Rodney, who looked as if he'd been the butt of a joke between Ronan and Shepard, once again. Watching them made me smile. I often wished I could be more involved with the off-world exploration, but that wasn't my role. Anyway, the debriefs, especially when John Shepard was leading them, were always entertaining. When I saw the grin on his face, I knew this would be a good one. And of course it was. It was amazing, Shepard said at the debrief. We were passing over the uninhabited planet when the jumper scanners picked up on an energy spike. But there was no sign of human life. Plenty of something that looked like a cow, though. So we decided to swing down and take a look. I don't know about the rest of you, but I could kill for a fresh steak sandwich every now and then. Rodney interrupted with an exasperated look on his face. Exploration dictated by your stomach, he muttered. I'm sure taxpayers would be delighted to hear about that. Shepard waved a hand dismissively. I'll lighten up, Rodney, he said. It worked out, didn't it? And now the only reason you've got your panties in a twist is that we've met a bunch of guys smarter than you. I held up a hand before McKay could reply. Once they got started, those two could go on for hours. So, Colonel, I asked, what did you find? He shrugged. Well, sadly, the cow things were a no-go. Apparently they're not good eating. But I haven't given up hope. Somewhere out there, I interrupted, and Colonel Shepard... He was suddenly all business, as he said. What we found was an entire civilization just sitting there. And the puddle jumper scanners didn't pick up on that, I asked. Shepard grinned again. Nope. And that's what's so cool about this planet. When the team had landed, they had initially found exactly what they had expected. Nothing but cows. They couldn't locate the source of the strange energy spike, and there was no sign that there was human life on the planet. But then Shepard told me, 1 minute, we are standing knee-deep in the undergrowth. The next, we are in the middle of a market square, surrounded by people. It was incredible. They just appeared out of nowhere. Actually, they didn't appear, added Rodney. We disappeared. Shepard dismissed the interruption. Yeah, I know, he said. But that's beside the point. The point is... It is not beside the point, Rodney snapped, incensed. It's a very salient point, the only point that actually matters. Rodney, I warned, and he subsided. The point Shepard was trying to make, he said then, was that when the team landed, they could see nothing and no one at all, anywhere. And then they could. They had found themselves in the middle of a settlement. It was more than a settlement. It was a city. Taylor talked about the amazing architecture. Shepard and Ronan were more interested in describing the technology. In Shepard's words, there were really cool flying cars. Wait, I interrupted, as the idyllic descriptions went on and on. The level of development you're describing is astonishing, especially for the Pegasus Galaxy. Has this planet never been culled? Shepard leaned back in his chair, clasping his hands behind his head with a distinctly smug look on his face. He waved an elbow towards McKay, saying, Go on, Rodney. Tell Elizabeth the best bit about this whole thing. McKay sighed. Well, they have technology that seems able to push them out of phase and thereby renders them not only invisible to the Wraith or to anyone else passing by, but immaterial, too. I stressed the word Seems, because I haven't examined the technology in any depth. Shepard leaned forward, elbows on the conference room table. We landed on that planet and saw no trace of human life. Nothing. Just cows. How do you explain that if it doesn't work, huh? McKay threw his hands up, exasperated. They weren't cows, he shouted. And an alien flying over Wisconsin wouldn't get the same idea? Come on. Anyway, it's failing, isn't it? That's why we saw the energy spike, and the Wraith would have seen it too. Renders it somewhat useless, if you ask me. It's not useless, Rodney, Shepard argued. It just needs you to do a bit of fixing up. Rodney snorted. Oh, yeah. Oh, and once again, it comes back to me doing all the work while you stand around with a gun and oogle the woman folk. Gentlemen, please. I looked at Rodney. Where's the catch? Catch, he scoffed. Well, let's see. How about we start with the laws of physics, Rodney? He paused for a minute, trying to ignore the look of triumph on Shepard's face. Leaving aside the astronomical amounts of energy needed to fuel a device of that kind, he asked. Well, let's see. There are the unknown effects of constantly shifting in and out of phase. There's the fact that I stopped him there. Rodney, is there a chance we can use this technology to protect Atlantis? Arms folded, he sighed impatiently and said, I need to look over the device more closely, but at first glance it seems promising, he squirmed as John beamed. Just imagine, Elizabeth, said Shepard. The Wraith could land right in the middle of Atlantis and not even know we're here. It was a wonderful thought. What did you mean earlier, I asked, when you said it was failing? Rodney shot Shepard a triumphant look. The raw materials required to sustain the shield are massive, he explained. They haven't been able to expand the area it covers for decades. I could guess what that meant. In any culture, limited resources meant conflict. The team told me that the population was booming. They don't have enough land to either feed or house their people, Rodney added. They don't have a Stargate or interplanetary travel, so they can't trade with outsiders. Frankly, the phase shift generator is at breaking point, and they need help. They need raw materials for the generator and a way to increase their crop yield. It's the only reason they brought us into their community. The food isn't a problem. Do we have the raw materials they need? I asked. McKay nodded. But it'll need careful handling, he warned me. Despite Shepard's rosy picture, Llanavulin is no paradise. Right. I could feel excitement beginning to bubble in my stomach. Here was something I could really get my teeth into. Okay, then. I'll inform Stargate Command, and let's get packed. Less than 12 hours later, I was standing on the deck of the Daedalus with Colonel Caldwell at the helm, en route to Llanavulin. It had been decided that McKay and I would spend some time on the planet, I to negotiate trade and Rodney to observe the shield. The Daedalus was meant as a passive show of force, a silent warning. I thought it was unnecessary macho posturing. These people didn't even have spaceflight capabilities, but was prepared to put up with it as long as Caldwell and his men didn't interfere. Caldwell sourly agreed to send just one soldier to accompany Rodney and myself, Lieutenant Travis. Trust is the first step in all negotiations. We had visited Llanavulin unbidden and had been not only welcomed but invited to return. To answer this by arriving with an armed escort would have sent a distinctly adverse message to our hosts. Even Travis made me uncomfortable. I needn't have worried. Arriving on the planet, our little party was met by Prime Minister Konak himself. Entering the phase shift was one of the stranger experiences of my life. I'm not saying something. We stood in an entirely empty meadow as around us an entire city coalesced, seemingly out of thin air. I felt a strange hum pass through me, the only indication that we were entering the shift. Once we had fully entered phase, I could see the city stretching away to the foothills of the mountains we had seen from orbit. The buildings around us were sparkling clean and tranquil in the sunset. Prime Minister Konak exuded an air of composure that immediately put me at ease as he welcomed us to Llanavulin. There was to be a reception in our honor, but McKay was more interested in getting straight to work. Konak was happy to summon a small clutch of scientists to assist McKay, and I sent Caldwell's soldier with him. I felt perfectly safe in Konak's company, and knew I would learn more about Lanavulin politics and customs at the reception than I would by following Rodney. The room into which I was ushered was even more palatial than the surroundings I had already seen. The ceiling soared high above our heads, with elegant paintings depicting beautiful pastoral scenes on each segment of the huge dome. The room was full of people who all paused and turned towards Konak and myself as we entered, nodding in welcome as we joined the throng. I'd been at quite a few such diplomatic events throughout my career, but I confess I was overwhelmed. Everyone Konak introduced me to was eager to discuss how our parallel systems of government worked in as minute a detail as possible. After several hours during which I seemed to speak non-stop, I was exhausted. Excusing myself, I asked Konak for a moment alone, and taking a glass from a nearby waiter, slipped out into one of the balconies. The sun had set. There was a still, pale glow in the sky illuminating the myriad spires of the city. Above their jagged silhouettes shone the planet's twin moons. And all of this, myself included, was completely hidden from the universe. Amazing. I looked down at the glass I held. Taking a sip, I coughed immediately. It was strong, burning my throat. As my eyes watered, I heard a soft laugh and turned to see a figure approaching.
I see you've discovered our planet's traditional drink of choice, Dr. Weir. It's an acquired taste. Here, have some water.
Oh, thank you, Mr.
My name is Villeth. My title is Minister, but please ignore that. Many other people try to. Welcome to Lanavulin, Dr. Weir.
Thank you, Minister Villeth. And do your ministerial duties usually involve standing around with convenient glasses of water?
I saw you take the drink, Doctor, and thought you would probably need it.
Villeth was tall and broad-shouldered, with a sweep of long white blonde hair. His laughter lit up his features, and I felt myself smiling back as I took a few more mouthfuls of water and set the glass down. This is a beautiful planet. I feel lucky to see it, Minister.
Ah, you are seeing but a fraction of its beauty. To the north are the snow-covered mountains of Zar. The coolness of their peaks, a welcome contrast to the heat of the south. And then there are the beaches at Tabor. Soft, white sand edged by an ocean of the purest azure blue. We have forests, too, deep and ancient and untouched. And caves, where some say mythical creatures lurk, hidden for centuries.
It sounds wonderful.
It is wonderful, Dr. Weir. More wonderful than you can imagine. And us, too.
What do you mean?
My people can never experience those places. The phase shift cannot reach that far.
Of course.
I must confess that sometimes it seems an unbearable price to pay.
I assure you, there are many planets in this galaxy that would gladly make the trade, Minister.
Perhaps. But I doubt they would also trade for the poverty that accompanies our dependence on the shield.
We hope to be able to help you with that.
By extending the shift, yes. But by how far? And how long until we have again exhausted its reach? Forgive me, Dr. Weir. This is an old argument, but not one in which you are at fault.
No forgiveness is necessary. I understand your frustration. But truly, your ability to hide so effectively is to be congratulated. Not every culture in the Pegasus Galaxy has been so lucky. This planet that you love so much, if you were not hidden, it would not exist, or at least not like this.
But at what price? Our children are starving, Dr. Weir. This part of the city may be gleaming and beautiful, but beyond its walls our people live in squalor, while out there on the plains is space and food enough for us all to live in luxury. Out there in the universe, there are peoples like you, people we could be trading with, learning from. And yet our fear prevents us.
It is difficult, I know.
It is more than difficult. It is criminal.
I didn't answer. unsure what to say in response. After a moment, Vilith glanced at me.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be. I'm glad to hear your opinions, and I want to get a proper understanding of the situation. Until now, I didn't know there were objections to the phase shift.
While we are dependent on the generator, my people will be oppressed.
And yet, while it produces the shift, they're safe in the Wraith, Vilith.
Ah, yes. The Wraith. The so-called scourge of the galaxy.
An accurate description.
Really? You have first-hand experience of them?
I do.
And from this experience, you have determined that they are all, the entire race, evil.
What point are you trying to make, Minister?
As you say, it is important to understand all the aspects of an issue.
Indeed, it is.
You do not generalize.
I try not to.
And yet, you do not extend the Wraith the same courtesy.
It is complicated. The Wraith are a special case.
Ah, of course.
They can't be negotiated with. They are violent. To them, we're merely a food source, nothing more.
And this you know from your own experiences?
Yes.
But how do you know that those experiences apply to the Wraith as a whole? Can you be sure you have a complete knowledge of their race?
Perhaps not. But nothing we've learned has shown us anything else.
No, nothing. Nothing at all.
I paused, remembering Shepard's recent run-in with Kolya and the Wraith he met there. He'd been given back his life. And then I thought of the report that Dr. Beckett had made of the Wraith child, Elia. Phyllis saw my hesitation.
It is interesting, is it not, Dr. Weir, how even rational, enlightened people are given to generalization at times. Again, please forgive me. I did not mean to embarrass you. It is only that I know what it is to live with stigma, and I merely wish to make a point.
I wish it were a valid one. Usually it would be. Unfortunately, where the Wraith are concerned, you are better off accepting the consensus opinion.
For many of my people, all they know is the state-sanctioned poverty they have been subject to for many years. They will not let us leave, to make our lives elsewhere. We're treated like children, threatened by phantoms to keep us in check, while the politicians become fat and comfortable in their luxurious spaces. Look around you. This reception is a perfect example. Half our people do not eat properly from day to day, yet here there is plenty.
The poverty we can help you with. Believe me, without the shield, you would have ample reason to fear the Wraith.
So Konak would have us believe. How convenient for him that you concur.
I assure you that I am not here for Konak's benefit, Minister. We want to help your people. All of them.
Then help us be free of the shield.
Minister Vilith, my reply was interrupted by Konak, who bustled up with two other men. He insisted with a frown that Vilith not monopolize my company and led me back into the reception, one hand firmly on my elbow. I turned my head to look back at Minister Vilith, but all I saw was a flash of his hair as he walked toward the exit, apparently flanked by Konak's two companions. By the time I was shown to my quarters, I was exhausted. I sat on the edge of the bed and pondered the evening's events. Minister Villa's strange departure concerned me. I suspected he'd been asked to leave, which wasn't a huge surprise. After all, he had been deliberately trying to influence my opinion against Konak. I pulled my boots off, troubled. My conversation with Villith bothered me. I'd long prided myself on my open-mindedness and tolerance, and firmly believed that each individual should stand on their own merit. But the minister was right. I didn't apply those same standards to the Wraith. That fear clouded my ability to be open-minded where the Wraith were concerned. What if, one day, we actually found a final solution? We came so close with the retrovirus. What if we used a final solution and too late, discovered a resistance? What if Stargate Command had obliterated the Gueld before they discovered the Tok'ra? Just because we didn't think that the Wraith could be anything other than what we'd seen. That didn't mean we were right. We didn't know everything. I lay back on the pillows, staring at the ceiling. Shepard and Caldwell would call me mad for thinking like this. But wasn't that precisely why Atlantis was under civilian, not military, command? So that someone did think such thoughts before it was too late. The length of my day suddenly caught up with me, and I felt my eyes closing. I jolted awake to discover early morning light streaming through the windows. I opened the door to Rodney, who pushed past me without waiting for an invite. "You know what? I think they might be onto something," he said, with an animation that I knew from experience meant I was in for an excited explanation. "The phase shift, you mean?" I asked. "Of course the phase shift. That's why we're here, isn't it?" He paced up and down. "The design is really quite ingenious. There are flaws, of course, but luckily for them, I'm here. There's no reason that it shouldn't work. I'm sure to be able to modify it for Atlantis with a minimum of effort if we can amortize the power drain, which is the big question. Bottom line is, this is definitely something we want. You're good to go ahead and do your negotiating, as far as I'm concerned." "Thanks, Rodney. I'm so grateful," I said dryly. "Yes, yes, I thought you would be," he replied, with no hint that he'd picked up my tone. There was a pause. "Is that all?" I asked. Yes. He moved towards the door, mind already elsewhere. "Good luck with the negotiations. Remember, we really want this." "I'll try not to forget," I told him. I headed for the shower. I'd only gone a few paces before the door chimed again. I sighed impatiently, wondering what Rodney had forgotten to tell me. I opened the door rather more brusquely than I usually would, and was surprised to see who was standing outside. "Minister Villith."
"Good morning, Dr. Weir. I'm sorry to bother you so early. I wanted to catch you before you began your day. Perhaps I misjudged."
"No, no, not at all. What can I do for you?"
"Firstly, I wanted to apologize for my behavior last night. I should not have cornered you as I did."
"Really, Minister, there's no need."
"Please believe that it is sincere concern that drives me, nothing more."
"I don't doubt that."
"I wonder, would you allow me to show you my side of the city?"
"Your side?"
"Where I am from, where I live, the people I represent. It might help you understand a little better."
"I'm not..."
"Please, Dr. Weir. It will not take long. You did say that understanding a situation fully is important."
I hesitated. I knew Connacht would be displeased, but Villith was right. I did need to understand the situation on the planet fully before I started negotiating. How could I refuse his request to show me both sides? "I've got to be back in time for the opening of my talks with Connacht."
"You have my word. You will be back in plenty of time."
"Okay, then. Just give me a few minutes." Villith was right. Getting to what he called the outer city didn't take long at all. It was, as he described, just beyond the inner city wall. And yet, it was like walking into a different world. Here, the streets were just ruts in the dirt, and the ramshackle houses slouched towards each other in the dusty air. Old men sat in the dirt, selling sparse items, vegetables, firewood, anything they could gather together, it seemed. It was such a violent contrast to what lay within the city walls that I could find nothing to say. For a time we walked in silence, broken only by people greeting the minister as he passed and children begging me for sweets and money. It reminded me of many places I had visited in the developing world back on Earth. Poverty was dire and palpable. Eventually we reached a house very slightly larger and better kept than the others we had passed, and stopped.
"Welcome to my home, Dr. Weir."
Inside the house was an oasis of calm, a shelter from the fierce heat outside.
"There is far more I could show you. The conditions worsen further from the city walls towards the perimeter.
It's... I confess, the difference is more striking than I had expected.
I have lived here all my life. I brought my son up here, and I still find it shocking.
I am glad that Atlantis will be able to help your people. Extending the phase shift will mean more space, less overcrowding.
Dr. Weir, I know your intentions are honorable, but the same does not go for the people you are here to deal with. Do you think they would have shown you this part of the city left to their own discretion? Of course not. They want you to see all the shining examples of Lana Vulin that exist within the city walls. You have seen the space they have. It has been within their power to ease the suffering of my people for many years, and they have refused. They see us as second-class citizens, not worthy of residing in better conditions. They take land from this sector for their crops, forcing people out of their scant homes to provide it, but do not give anything back.
But Konak hasn't hidden your poverty from us. His request for help specifically mentioned it.
Sure it did. But how better to secure help than by couching it as charity? The generator needs renewing, and we have no more room for crops for either the inner or outer city.
I don't understand. Where does this divide come from? Why don't the inner city help you?
It goes back many centuries to before the phase shift, when our peoples were simple tribes. Some worshipped one god and some another. Our forefathers, unfortunately, were not on the winning side of the resulting war. We have been paying the price for those differences ever since.
I stood up, walking to the window. Sadly, it was a common story, even on Earth. Phyllis, I understand you wanting me to see this. And I'll stress again that Atlantis will help your people any practical way we can. I can raise these issues with Konak now that I'm aware of them. We'll make it a condition of our trade that these inequalities are dealt with, that this ancient rift is healed. But I cannot advocate the removal of the shield. It would be suicide.
You think it would be suicide? You can't know that for sure.
Phyllis, if this planet weren't protected by the phase shift, it would be culled. It is that simple. If the phase shift were not in operation, Lana Vulin wouldn't exist as it does now.
How would it exist?
The city would be devastated.
The people would be reduced to scratching an existence?
I could see where he was going with this. I didn't answer.
You see how hard it is to understand quite why that would make a difference to us here in the outer city, Dr. Weir.
The difference is that many of you would be dead, Vilith. And those of you left alive would live in fear of every new culling.
If we were culled.
Exasperated, I kept silent. Vilith stood and came to join me at the window.
What if the Wraith had a reason not to cull us?
There is no reason you could offer them, Vilith.
No, that is not what our ancient texts say.
Ancient texts?
There are records from the time before the phase shift that Konak and his men try to suppress. They tell of the Wraith in more peaceful terms than you have described, and Konak would have us believe. They say that those willing to serve the Wraith are met with reason and bounty. They are allowed to live out their lives in peace.
Serve the Wraith?
Yes. The books tell tales of people taken from this planet to live amongst the stars with their masters. Some were taken to other worlds, some stayed aboard their great ships. The rest of the population remained here, without a shield, safe and happy. And free. Free to work this land, all of this land, and live in plenty.
My skin crawled as I understood what Vilith was saying. Serve the Wraith. Is that what had caused the rift between these people so long ago? Is that what Vilith's plan was now? In their poverty and desperation, these people were willing to worship these creatures? The horror I felt must have shown in my face. because Vilith grimaced and turned away.
I see that you do not think it is a good idea.
No, Vilith. It's definitely not a good idea. And I know that if you truly understood what the Wraith are, you wouldn't think so either. Serve the Wraith? How could you? Why would you?
Why? Why? Because I have exhausted all other means of helping my people. Because no matter what I try, it comes back to the greed and insatiability of those who have never had to go without. Because I know that if we do not remove the shield, they will have an excuse to let the suffering continue.
Serving the Wraith isn't the way, Vilith. Believe me.
Oh. And how much worse could it be than this?
Much. Much worse. Even if they accepted your worship, not all of you would live. And how could you live with yourself knowing you were serving masters who routinely killed thousands of your fellow humans? He looked away.
A necessary evil, perhaps. I cannot look after the entire galaxy, Dr. Weir. But I can help the people here.
Evil is never necessary. This is desperation speaking, Vilith. Atlantis can and will alleviate that. You bringing me here has changed the way I will approach our negotiations. We can make provisions.
How long will that take? Too long is the answer. People here are dying every day. You may be able to help in the short term, but once your back is turned, Konak and his government will return to their old ways.
We will make sure that won't happen. I wish I could do more, Minister.
I know. And I am grateful for it.
I really need to be getting back. We're here. The voice was almost drowned by noise in the background. It sounded like a war zone. Explosions raged in my ear.
Colonel Caldwell!
I shouted. Is that you?
Deadless Weir, come in.
I read you, Colonel. What's happening? There was another crackle, and I heard the words...
Attack. Wraith, hive.
Colonel, you're breaking up. You're under attack? My heart hammered as I strained to hear Caldwell's words. After a couple more moments, the Colonel's voice clarified.
Dr. Weir, we are under attack. A hive came out of nowhere. You need to evacuate now.
I glanced up at Villa. He was listening intently. Evacuate? Can you transport us even if we're out of phase?
Dr. McKay thinks we can by targeting a small enough area.
Caldwell shouted over the noise around him.
But for that, we need all three of you together. You have to get back to the others.
Understood.
Hurry, Doctor. We're taking fire.
I'll be there, I answered. We're out. I looked up at Vilith. I'm sorry, Minister. I've got to go, but I promise we'll be back. I want to help.
I know you do, Dr. Weir.
He looked distracted as I asked, can you take me back?
I have something I must attend to, but I will send someone else with you. There is a swift route.
He reached out, clasping my hand with a sad smile.
Go quickly, and go safely, Dr. Weir.
And then he ushered me to the door. The journey back to the inner city was brief. McKay and Travis had convened in a monitoring room, watching the events in orbit via a network of computer screens. Konak was also present. He nodded to me coolly as I entered. He obviously knew where I'd been, but I didn't care. What I had seen outside the city walls was enough to temper my earlier conviction of his good nature. "Have you heard nothing more from the Daedalus?" I asked. McKay shook his head, mouth set in a grim line. I picked up my radio. "Daedalus, come in. This is Dr. Weir. We are ready and waiting." There was a pause, during which I feared the worst. And then the crackle returned, and I heard Caldwell's voice over the din.
Daedalus here, Doctor. Good to know.
But the battle was not going well. Caldwell reported that they had hull breaches and were losing power. We're ready to transport when you are, Colonel, I told him.
Stand by, Doctor.
Nothing happened. 15 seconds passed. 20. McKay and I shared a look. Colonel Caldwell, I said into the radio.
Stand, Doctor. We're... malfunction.
Go again, Colonel. I'm losing you.
Transporter down.
There was more crackles, and the signal stabilized for a moment, Caldwell's voice becoming louder.
Dr. Weir, the transporter is down. We can't retrieve you.
My heart quailed, my fear mirrored in the faces of McKay and Travis. I swallowed and replied with a calmer voice than I felt. Understood, Colonel. Return to Atlantis. Come back to get us when you can.
Negative,
he said.
We're not leaving you behind, Doctor.
We're safe here under the shield. The longer you hold the position, the more suspicious they'll get. Go, now. There was a pause before Caldwell came back.
Sit tight, Doctor. We'll be back for you as soon as we can. Caldwell out.
The radio fell silent. You will be quite safe here with us, Dr. Weir, said Konak. It will give you a chance to see how valuable our phase shift generator is. I nodded. I'm sure... What the hell? The explosion shook the walls and rattled the windows. Objects fell from tables, crashing to the floor. Is that the Wraith? I asked. A flash of panic passed Konak's face before he shook his head. Impossible, he insisted. Then what was it? Shouted McKay. Because whatever it was pretty darn close. McKay and Travis went to the window as a messenger ran in to speak to Konak. What is it? I asked. What's going on? McKay shouted from the window before Konak had a chance to answer. I can see smoke and rubble, he said. The sound of gunfire suddenly rattled in the middle distance. There's a battle going on down there, and it doesn't look like it's against the Wraith. Konak looked at me, a shadow passing his face. It's Vilith, he said. He's attacking the phase shift generator. It was as if the next few minutes passed in slow motion. My ears were still ringing from the blast, and I was horrified by the idea that Vilith was trying to destroy the only barrier between us and a hive full of Wraith. On the computer monitors, the Daedalus could be seen limping away from orbit. Could it even make it into hyperspace? Is the hive pursuing? I asked. It doesn't look like it, Rodney replied grimly. That blast caused a massive spike in power to the generator. I think they detected it. I held my breath. If the hive wasn't following the Daedalus, it meant she had a chance. But if Vilith lowered the shield while the hive was still in orbit... It didn't bear thinking about. Outside, the sounds of battle intensified. A pall of smoke rose above the pristine roofs of the inner city, and below, I could see soldiers running towards the fray. I felt someone at my elbow and turned to see Konak. They will soon be stopped, he told me, his tone dismissive. Their weapons are no match for ours. Besides, even if they do penetrate the generator's defenses, there is not one man among them with the knowledge to lower it. They are nothing more than a disorganized rabble. I looked out the window. Perhaps. But desperation and opportunity can be potent substitutes for preparation. I felt him tense beside me. You almost sound as if you are sympathetic towards these terrorists, Dr. Weir. Sympathetic to their tactics, no. To their plight? I would have thought anyone would be minister. Konak threw up his hands in exasperation. What would you have me do, Dr. Weir? Let them turn off the generator. I had no answer for that. Vilith and his people were, without a doubt, horribly misguided. Currently, our only chance for survival was that Konak's forces repel the attack. But how I wished I'd arrived in Lanavulin sooner. That I'd been given a chance to help before all of this got so far out of hand. I nodded towards the monitors displaying the scenes of fighting outside. They don't seem to be showing any signs of defeat. The battle is fierce, admitted Konak. I confess we were not expecting them to be so well prepared. Rest assured, however, that we will prevail. They are untrained vandals battling highly skilled soldiers. We will overcome them soon. Before they damage the generator, I asked, gauging his expression carefully. Of course. Konak's accompanying smile was strained, and his eyes betrayed a concern that he managed to keep out of his voice. Perhaps it would be better if you and your team returned to your quarters, Dr. Weir. You'll be safer there. Over the next few hours, McKay, myself, and Travis listened to bulletins from the ministry. The fight was not going well for the government. The initial explosion had breached the wall of the generator building, and the rebels were now fighting to gain entrance. A little later, they did. "We're so screwed," said Rodney, pacing nervously as the news came in that Konak's men had lost the position. "We might as well bare our chests and wait for the call." Konak said security within the complex is very tight, I pointed out. "They aren't going to find it easy to break into the computer programs controlling the generator." McKay sat down opposite me and asked, "Why would anyone do this? How can they possibly think this is a good idea?" I shrugged, rubbing a hand over my eyes. "They're desperate, Rodney. Their government won't help them. This morning I told their leader that we couldn't help them, at least not in the way they want, and then boom, there is a hive ready and waiting." "Well, their leader must be insane." "He's not insane, Rodney. Just misguided. He has his reasons." "Reasons?" Rodney scoffed. "I'd like to see you try to reason with someone like that." He stood up and resumed his pacing. His words rang in my head. Reason? Could Vilith be reasoned with? We'd shared two conversations from which it was clear he valued debate. But I hadn't been able to convince him. Could I find a way now? I stood. There must have been something in my expression, because McKay stopped pacing and looked at me warily. "What?" he asked. "You're right, Rodney." "I am," he said nervously. "What about?" I walked to the door. "You're going to join the Lanavulin scientists and see if there's anything you can do to help." I held up a hand as he tried to interrupt. "If anyone can find a solution, it's you. I'm going to persuade Konak to let me attempt negotiation with Vilith." McKay snorted. "Negotiate," he repeated. "With the crazy Wraith fans? Yeah, good luck with that." Konak's reaction was very similar to McKay's. "Dr. Weir, what you suggest is out of the question," was his first response. "These are not people to talk to. They are violent criminals who wish destruction on our entire race, as you have seen for yourselves. I have called in reinforcements, and we are surrounding the generator building. They cannot escape." "You're planning to storm the building?" I asked. Konak nodded curtly. "As soon as we have all our troops in place, yes." "Minister Konak, at least let me try. What have you to lose? If I fail, you can storm the building, but you and I both know what the outcome will be if you force your way in. Bloodshed. And more bloodshed. And perhaps the generator will be damaged beyond repair. Can you risk that?" An aide moved to speak in Konak's ear, and they stepped aside to discuss my request. In the background, the gunfire continued, but it was lessening. A siege mentality was setting in. Both sides watchful, careful, but perversely at rest. Fingers were on triggers, but there was a breathing space. That was where I could fit in. Before the gunfire started again in earnest, there would be a pause, one in which I could place a diplomatic wedge. Or at least that was what I hoped. Konak nodded slowly. "Very well," he said. "But you do not have long, Dr. Weir. There are more deserving lives at stake than those inside that building. The Wraith..." "I have people here too, remember," I interrupted. "Just let me try." Konak frowned. "Obviously you must be armed and take an escort, Dr. Weir." "That is out of the question," I said firmly. "I will go alone and unarmed." "But that's madness," Konak argued. "They'll shoot you before you even get close to their lines." "I don't believe that, Konak. Make a statement saying that you're willing to talk, and let's see what happens." "Elizabeth, are you sure about this?" asked Rodney, who was hovering behind me. "This is what I do, Rodney. I've negotiated situations like this many times on Earth." "That's not as reassuring as you think it is," he said with a frown. "Just do what you can to help," I told him. I watched him reluctantly head toward the group of scientists standing in an anxious huddle. A shiver ran through me, and I swallowed hard. I'd been trying to reassure myself as well as Rodney. The Pegasus Galaxy was a long way from Earth. and there was no guarantee that what I'd learned there would work here. But I had to try. I could see no other way. Travis checked my radio as Konak announced through a loudspeaker that they were sending someone over to talk. As I suspected, the response came that as long as the negotiator came unarmed and alone, Vilith would let them through. Still, the situation was a volatile one. Vilith was willing to listen, but it was his followers who held the guns. I had to hope that their fingers wouldn't be shaky on the trigger. I was possibly more terrified than I had ever been in my life. But despite that fear, I tried to appear calm, confident, even, despite my nerves. I hadn't been posturing when I had told Rodney that this was what I did. It was true. Diplomacy, negotiating, finding a middle way through some truly nightmarish situations, that was what I was trained for. In spite of all the differences and unknowns, in some ways I felt as if right then I was getting back to my roots, back to what made me a part of the Atlantis mission in the first place. Silence reigned. The generator building was on one corner of an empty square. I paused before beginning to cross it, but there was no sign of movement. No gunfire. I have never felt as physically vulnerable as I did crossing that space. Behind me was the full might of the Llanavulin military. Ahead of me, a group of armed malcontents. And above me, a hive full of wraith. And this mission had started so well. There was a shout before I reached the building's door. "Stop there," said the voice. Not Vilith. "Lie on the ground, shut your eyes, spread your arms and legs." I did as I was told, heart hammering. I was surrounded by how many I couldn't tell. One knelt beside me, binding my hands, while another forced my head up, tying a blindfold over my eyes. I felt my radio being taken from my pocket. Then they dragged me up and pulled me towards the building. I heard the door slam shut behind me and stumbled as they took me up a short flight of stairs. I was thrust into a chair and heard the footsteps leave, a door shutting roughly. This wasn't the first time I'd been in a situation like this, but it never gets any easier. I took deep, slow breaths, trying to calm myself. My wrists were already sore. A moment later, I heard Billet's voice talking to someone just outside the door.
"Maureen, there was no need for such violence. Whomever they have sent is a peacemaker."
"Father, you're too trusting," said the voice. "It is sure to be a trap on Cornac's part."
"Did I raise you to be so suspicious?"
"No,"
said the younger voice.
"The city did that."
"Well, let us see who the inner city have sent to speak for them."
The door opened, and his footsteps came into the room and stopped. There was a pause, and then I heard Vilith utter an exclamation.
"Dr. Weir!"
He pulled the blindfold from my face and started undoing my wrists.
"What are you doing here?"
"I came to talk, Vilith."
I mean, what are you still doing in the city? I thought you had returned to Atlantis with your ship."
"The Hive damaged our ship too badly."
"I did not know. We saw your ship leave, and I thought... I did not want you involved in this. Your people, I mean."
"Would your actions have been different if you'd known we were here?"
"Truthfully, no. Who knows when we would have got another opportunity to act, with the Wraith so near."
"Vilith, we have to talk."
"I find it amusing that it is you who come to speak to me, Dr. Weir, and not one of Konak's people. He has never been willing to talk. And so I know that you are here merely to stop us deactivating the generator, rather than to offer us hope that our suffering will end."
"I have tried to offer you hope, Vilith. I can offer you hope."
"But only a small measure. And even then you cannot guarantee it. And now, here we are, so close to disabling the shield. Your offers are not enough to make us change our minds."
"What would be enough, Vilith?" I saw him hesitate. Come on, Villith. If what we're offering, an extension of the shield, isn't enough, then what is? The bottom line is that the shield has to stay up. Beyond that, tell me what you want. I'll see if I can make it happen.
Why should I negotiate with you, Dr. Weir, when I hold the position of power? We are here. We have the generator. In less than 30 minutes, my people will have broken through the security codes and will disable it. Why should I negotiate now when the time for talking is past?
Because you know in your heart of hearts that this is wrong. You know it, Villith.
How can achieving everything we want, everything we need, be wrong? We will become a nation of worshippers, and in return the Wraith will let us live freely.
If you do this, you will never be free. You will condemn these people, the people you want to help, to slavery or death. And both will be more painful than the lives they now have.
You cannot know that.
Villith, even if what I know of the Wraith doesn't represent the totality, it certainly speaks for the majority. If you power down the generator now, everyone, everything you love will die. There was a shout from outside the room. Villith went to the door and I followed. Morin came up, a strange look on his face. It combined excitement and fear in equal measure.
What is it?
Morin grabbed his father's arm, pulling him to the window. The Wraith are here, he said. They are in the city. My stomach turned over. For a moment, I thought he meant they had found a way to breach the phase shift. But no. As I looked out, I could see ghostly figures walking the streets, drifting in and out of walls that for them did not exist. They were searching for signs of human habitation. They were searching for us. Morin stood beside his father, watching them. He seemed very young. I guess he could not be more than 17 or 18. I wondered where his mother was. Morin was breathing fast. He was afraid. Villith laid a hand on his shoulder.
They are our saviors, my son.
Morin nodded, but his stance told another story. I understood. Even seeing pictures of Wraith had not prepared me for my first sight of one in the flesh. This boy hadn't even had that insight. Are we really going to meet them, Father? He asked.
Are you afraid?
Villith's son let his silence answer for him. I saw Villith nod slowly.
They are more fearsome than I too imagined. Go, get me a progress report.
As the boy left, Villith turned, and I could see doubt in his eyes. Hope surged inside me.
Well, Dr. Weir, what would you offer if I were to promise not to power down the generator? It is always good, as we have previously established, to be in possession of all the facts before deciding on a course of action.
I smiled. Tell me what you want, Villith, and I will gladly negotiate with Konak on your behalf. There was a sudden shout from outside. A spatter of gunfire broke the silence, precipitating a full-scale battle.
Konak is attacking. Defend the building!
Villith ran from the room. I looked around, heart beating wildly as chaos shattered the relative calm. I saw, dumped on a table, the radio Morin had taken from me earlier. No one took any notice when I snatched it back, too preoccupied by the sudden, all-consuming battle. Gunfire poured through the shattered windows. In front of me, I saw one of Villith's men hit. He was sent crashing across the room, the force of the blast pinning him to the wall before he slid to the floor, amongst a pool of his own blood. Smoke plumed everywhere. The acrid tang of weapons fire choking everything. I crouched down in a corner as low as I could and pressed the radio to my ear. Rodney, I shouted over the din. Weir to McKay, come in. His voice came back almost immediately and I had to block my other ear to hear him.
Elizabeth, my God, I thought you were... when we didn't hear from you.
I could be dead yet, Rodney. Why has Konak attacked? I was getting somewhere.
It seemed the Wraith on the planet. He panicked.
I shut my eyes. Even if I had time, I'd never get Villith back on side now. Unless... Okay, I said, trying to keep my voice even. Rodney, I'm going to give it one last shot, but if I don't succeed... I tailed off. Anything else I might have said was cut off as mortar shot through the window in front of me, exploding in a miniature fireball and throwing me hard against the wall. I forced myself back to my feet, head ringing, pushing the radio back into my pocket. I picked my way towards the generator room. Willith stood, weapon in hand, shouting orders as he looked over the shoulders of his men working on the generator.
Keep going. We'll protect you. The Wraith walk among us, and it is time to end our oppression.
Willith!
He turned to look at me.
You see, Dr. Weir, they would not even let you speak.
They're afraid, Willith. They've seen the Wraith, and they're afraid. Just as your son is. Just as you are. He moved from where he stood, walking towards me. I could see the desperation in his eyes.
I have no choice. Can't you see that? If I surrender now, they will crush us. But with the Wraith, I may have a chance.
There is always a choice, Willith.
Certain death at the hands of my own people, or possible death at the hands of the Wraith. Not much of one, Dr. Weir.
Certain death. At the hands of the Wraith, too, Willith. He shook his head. Through my frustration, an idea came to me. It was a desperate idea, as desperate as the one these people had launched against the generator. And it was just as insane, but it was something. I put my hand on Willith's arm. Why not meet the Wraith?
We will, soon.
No. Why don't you meet the Wraith? Just you. Address them yourself. See what happens. If you still think them worthy masters, offer them your people as their worshippers. Risk only yourself, not everyone else in Lanavulin. He looked at me, hesitant. Why not? I asked. Prove to me that what I know of the Wraith isn't true. If the Wraith have a benevolent side, if they want worshippers, then you'll know for sure. There was a pause. Behind Willith, Morin looked horrified. Father, you can't, he said. What if it's a trap? Willith ignored him.
How?
When I first arrived in the city, we couldn't see Lanavulin, though we were inside the phase shift's reach. Somehow we were pulled inside it.
That's right. You would have been assigned a tracker. It allows the phase shift to take place. If we disable our trackers, we will come out of phase shift and be visible to the Wraith.
If you do that, the Hive and every Wraith aboard will know there are humans on the planet. What we need to do is to assign one of the Wraith a tracker. Bring it into the phase shift. Then, if all goes well, you have the option of taking the entire city at a phase. I paused. Give your people another choice, Willith.
Very well.
He turned away to talk to one of his men. My heart leapt with a relief that was immediately dampened as I looked at the faces around me. I grabbed my radio again. We're to McKay. There was a pause before McKay's voice came back.
McKay here.
Let me talk to Konak. Rodney hesitated.
I'm not sure...
Get me Konak now! A moment passed, and Konak's voice echoed through the crackle.
Dr. Weir,
said Konak's voice, scathing.
This is not...
I cut him off. You have to cease your fire and allow these people out of this building.
Are they surrendering?
He asked. No, but...
Then we will not cease fire, Dr. Weir.
Insisted Konak.
We have Wraith in the city.
Listen to me, Konak. We are going to bring a Wraith into phase shift. Willith will see what they really are. And then this will all be over.
Are you insane?
And Konak shouted.
You intend to bring a Wraith into our phase.
It is either that, or Willith moves the entire city at a phase shift. The choice is yours. Konak paused.
And you want me?
His tone made my blood run cold. Yes. We have very young people here, Konak.
That's too bad, Dr. Weir,
Konak said.
They made their choice. We will never allow them to take us back to the old days of fear and death.
I cut the radio. There was nothing more to say.
We have selected a wraith, Dr. Weir.
Make sure you have as many weapons trained on it as possible.
That will be few. Konak's men are not letting up.
I nodded. Around us clustered a handful of Vilith supporters. Vilith moved to the center of the room. Morin, standing in front of me, made as if he wanted to join his father, but I put a hand on his arm and shook my head. Outside, the pitched battle continued. But here an expectant silence fell. I saw Vilith glance at one of the men seated at the generator console.
Do it.
For a moment, nothing happened. Then there was a brief shimmer in the air, and the wraith was before us. For a second, it was disoriented. I felt Vilith hesitate, apprehensive despite himself. Then he gathered himself and spoke.
Welcome. We are your willing servants.
The wraith shook its head as if trying to clear it. And I remembered the strange hum that had overtaken me when I first arrived. Then it looked around, slowly. My hand was still on Morin's arm, and I felt him shiver. The wraith had such a cold, reptilian look. Its eyes exuded cruelty, and nothing else.
There are humans here,
it said.
Yes, and we wish...
How do you hide from us?
The wraith interrupted, as if Vilith had not spoken.
We have technology, but we no longer wish to hide. We wish to serve you.
The wraith began to walk in a circle around Vilith, reminding me of a shark with its prey, more intense under my hand.
Serve us,
repeated the wraith.
And how do you intend to do that?
As our ancestors did. However you see fit. In return for being left to cultivate this land in peace.
The wraith stopped. Its cold eyes fixed on Vilith.
I see.
It hissed.
You want to bargain with us. You imagine you have something we want.
It twitched its feeding hand towards him. Morin cried out and ran forward. I tried to pull him back, but he shook me off.
Morin, stay back.
The wraith's hand paused, eyes narrowing as it looked at the boy.
Well,
said the wraith, glancing around the room again.
Perhaps you can be of some use to us.
Indeed, I believe we can. We are many here, and we are good workers.
My skin crawled as the wraith looked at Morin with an evil smile.
If you are many,
said the wraith softly,
then we definitely welcome you as our servant. We always reward those bringing us a fresh food source.
There was a split second of stillness. But I think I already knew what was coming. I saw Vilith's face blanch, but before he could move, the wraith had reached for Morin.
No!
I launched myself forward, knocking Morin to the floor, and out of the wraith's reach, I fell across him, pushing him down with one hand. The wraith roared as Vilith grabbed his other arm, trying to drag it away. It shook him off, and he flew across the room as it reached for me, dragging me up, turning me toward itself into the feeding position.
Remove the tracker! Get it out of here!
No! Kill it! You have to kill it! The wraith had me in both hands as I tried to twist away. I could feel its nails digging into my flesh as it tried to keep me still. Its feeding hand ripped at my uniform, scratching my neck. Kill it! Shoot it! Letting go of my arm, the wraith grabbed my hair instead, dragging my head back. I tried to kick out, but it made no impression. Its hand reached my chest and a needle-sharp pain prickled my skin. Shoot! And then I felt it. My blood boiled, and there was a rushing in my ears as if I was falling very fast. My head went light, and all I could see was the wraith's eyes narrowed into slits. There was the sound of weapons fire happening as if very far away. And then I felt something punch me in the side, but whatever pain it caused was drowned out by the wraith feeding. I felt myself falling, but didn't know if it was really happening or if it was just a precursor to death. And then I hit something hard, and everything went black. When I came around, Vilith was crouched over me. I was having trouble breathing. Across the room, I saw the wraith, lying in its own blood, wide-eyed, dead.
Dr. Weir?
The pain returned, worse than before, somewhere different. Reaching down, I felt my side. My hand came back, covered in blood.
You were shot. I am sorry. We could not kill the wraith without endangering you.
He hung his head. I couldn't reply.
It is over. We have surrendered. There is a medical team on its way.
I couldn't answer him. My vision swam again and darkness took over. The next time I woke, I was in a bed. McKay told me I had been there 3 days. What about the wraith? I asked McKay. Apparently, the Hive had stayed for 2 nights and then given up. Presumably, they were hungry and had gone in search of food. I shivered. And Vilith? His people? They had been arrested, of course, and imprisoned. The death toll had halted at 42. McKay told me that Vilith had been asking to see me ever since. There was a sudden commotion outside my room, and Shepard burst in, followed by Carson, Taylor, and Ronan. Elizabeth! Dr. Beckett exclaimed, rushing to my side with his medical kit and immediately beginning to examine me. How did you get here? I asked. Worked out the nearest gate and brought a puddle jumper, said Shepard, perching on the end of my bed. You don't look too good. I'll be fine, I said. I'm just tired. Carson looked at my chest, his face anxious. After a moment, he smiled. I don't think there's any permanent damage. From the wraith, anyway, he said. From what I understand, it only had its hand on you for a few seconds. Felt like longer, I said. Is she well enough to move, Doc? Shepard asked. Aye, it seems so, Carson smiled at me. Let's get you home, shall we? Wait. Wait. I need to talk to Vilith. Shepard glanced at Beckett. Is she the one who put you here? Please, John.
Dr. Weir, it is good to see you awake.
Vilith, it is good to see you alive. His wrists were chained, and behind him stood 2 armed guards. I looked away. I'd seen enough weapons for a while. How is Morin?
He is well. He's too young to be tried as an adult. He has been remanded in custody under child delinquency laws.
I nodded. We fell into silence.
Elizabeth, I am so very sorry.
So am I. I am sorry that I didn't get here sooner to find a better, more peaceful solution.
I hear that there have been skirmishes all over Lanavulin. I have brought this violence to my people. I squandered your good grace, and now we are in a worse situation than before, and without your guidance.
You can't get rid of me that easily, Vileth. He looked up at me, and I offered him a weak smile. I've told Konak that we will provide the materials you need. Atlantis still needs the phase shift technology, but one of the conditions is that peace must be negotiated through me with the Outer City, and Lana Vulin's prosperity shared.
I don't know what to say.
Thank you would be a start.
Thank you.
One of the guards moved forward. Phyllis' time was up.
You are returning to Atlantis?
Yes, but I'll be back. And I'll draft a treaty in the meantime. He smiled at me.
Goodbye, Dr. Weir.
You were supposed to come back, Elizabeth. I trusted you. I needed you. But you never came back. You left me. You left us. But you promised.
I would have done, if not for this.
We suffer because of you, Dr. Weir. And so does Atlantis. The city could have been protected once and for all if only you had agreed that treaty. The city could have been safe.
I didn't. There wasn't anything I could do. I didn't know what was coming.
So many excuses. You let me down. You let my son down. You let the entire expedition down. All your friends, your colleagues.
I'm sorry.
You broke your promise. And now so many people suffer because of it.
I don't break my promises. I don't. There has to be a way. I will find a way. One day I will go back. I'll find a way. One day.
I'm a complete addict for audiobooks. I listen to them all the time. I listen to the radio all the time. I listen to one radio show called This American Life. There's another one in Canada called Vinyl Museum. So I've grown up listening to audio stories, and I just think it's one of the most magical things. I was thrilled when you asked me.
This must be quite a unique experience because you played Weir on screen and then you were transferring her to audio drama. How's that for you? Did you have to think about her in a different way?
Well, it was interesting because I had to think about her in a different way, mostly not so much because of the medium, but because of the context. Because, you know, in my experience, Weir right now, I didn't know where she was going as far as the television show goes, so I'd kind of put her in a sort of coma state in my mind. And so all of a sudden, it was so wonderful to have this story to tell that answered some of my questions of where she could be. And I found it was a wonderful way for me to come to terms with putting Weir to rest in a way, if that seems strange. I don't think I did anything different. I enjoyed having the opportunity to explore her and voice her inner dialogue, which is one of the frustrations I've had from day one with her, is to not have that opportunity to explore what is keeping her awake at 3 a.m.
Was that type of adventure for Weir, going off world, is that the sort of thing that you would have liked to have seen in the show if you'd been writing it yourself?
Yes. I think definitely that was my frustration, is wanted her to have more of an active role.
Do you miss her as a character now that you haven't played her for a while? Is she someone that you think about, or is it just another role that you've moved on from?
No, I definitely think about her. I think especially because this last year it's been so strange. I haven't known if I'm coming back or not coming back. There's been no clarity as far as what her story goes. So that's been hard to put it to rest. Yeah, she crosses my mind a lot. Yeah, and I wish her well. And for all I know, she'll be back again next year with a red-haired actress playing her. And I'll tune in to see how she's doing.
Have you heard any more about whether you're going to be asked back?
Honestly, it's actually all just come out in the open now, so I think I can say it. I'm not coming back. They did come to me and ask me to come back this year, but it was very unclear as to what it was going to be, what they were going to ask her to do. And it was unclear as to if it was going to be a tidying up of her or if it was going to continue to be a vague, is she here, is she not there. And so that mixed with other contractual things, I chose not to do it. And it was sort of tough because I felt a sense of responsibility, and mostly, to be honest, towards the fans. I wanted to give them a sense of closure. And I felt that I was sort of being, you know, betraying by saying no to do it, but I didn't feel it was going to be a closure. I wasn't convinced that it was going to tidy it up. So I thought, well, then we're just going to continue this sort of vague dragging it on every year. And I wanted a clarity. And I thought that at the end of the day, however much the fans might be disappointed and not have her do it for another episode, I think they would appreciate my reasons why. I hope so.
Before you did the Stargate audiobook, had you done that sort of format
before? I haven't. I mean, I've done voiceovers for commercials, but no, I've never. I was very nervous going in, going, oh my gosh, how do you talk for an hour and keep it energetic? And so that was my first attempt at it.
And how did you find it as an overall experience?
I loved it. It was completely fun. I had no idea what to expect. I think you remember when I came in that morning, I'm like, so are we here for like 12 hours or an hour? I had no sense of what the setup was going to be. And it went much quicker than I thought.
And of course, we recorded in London, which you know very well, because you went to school there.
Yeah, I mean, my family is Welsh, so I was brought up in Britain for a little bit as a young girl. And then I went back to go to college there when I was, 18 or 19. I went to the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, darling. Yeah, so I have a huge love on with London, and I have a lot of friends there I met from college, and my family, a lot of my family live in London now, so I spent about 3 months there from October to January this year, and I make sure I go back at least once a year.
And what are you looking at doing now? Where do you want to go from here?
I might go to the beach this afternoon. I don't know actually. I am at a point in my life, I'm sort of, you know, not a young thing anymore, and I'm looking for a left turn. I will always act because I love acting. I love, you know, I actually saw a very funny stand-up thing this week. This guy was talking about this drug that he finally got off of, and it was acting. So I will always want to act. But I definitely, and I think I've spoken about this a bit in interviews the last few years, I'm definitely at a point that it'd be nice to have a bit more control in your life and a bit more creative control. So I am looking for a left turn. And if that is writing or directing, or maybe it's running a flower shop and selling coffee on the beach. Who knows? I'm open to all of it.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I'm not going to ask you any more questions.
My pleasure. Thank you.